From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, the CIA is accused of paying telecoms giant AT&T millions of dollars for customer phone records. We're in Geneva for the latest on a deal that could signal the first step to an international agreement over Iran's nuclear intentions.
Iran might suspend its 20% enrichment, that it would continue probably to transition its 20% stockpile into a form that couldn't be higher enriched for a weapon.
Sexual assault in the U.S. military is increasing. Our correspondent on the Hill brings us the story, and we look at why a new lethal injection cocktail in the U.S. could be causing a long and agonizing death.
They've never been tried before on a human being, so it's an experiment. Nobody knows. Even experienced doctors don't know how these drugs are going to react.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after a summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The U.S. telecoms multinational AT&T is providing phone call data voluntarily to the Central Intelligence Agency, according to the New York Times. The paper says the CIA pays the phone company to gain access to a vast database of global phone records. Daniel Wrenches reports from Washington.
The voluntary contract pays AT&T more than $10 million a year for a process in which the CIA provides the numbers of terrorism suspects around the world and gets back phone records to help intelligence analysts identify their associates. The information's been provided in the New York Times by what the paper refers to as government officials. The report says AT&T can access information not only from its own customers, but also from its network equipment worldwide.
The UK spy agencies are facing tough questions from MPs, which is being televised for the first time. The public grilling comes amidst leaks by the NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden that raise concerns over the level of spying done by UK and US intelligence agencies. From London, Natalie Powell has the latest.
The heads of the GCHQ, MI5 and MI6 have given evidence in private for many years, but this is the first time MPs are grilling intelligence directors in public. It follows on from a limited investigation by the Intelligence and Security Committee into claims that GCHQ used US surveillance program PRISM, which gathers information from internet firms, as a way of getting around British laws. The agency has been cleared of any wrongdoing on this, but MPs are now looking at whether surveillance laws need updating for the internet age.
The U.S. is taking action to ban trans fats. Food safety authorities say trans fats pose a significant threat to public health. If banned, officials say thousands of lives could be saved each year. After strong demand in advance of its initial public offering, Twitter begins trending on the New York Stock Exchange at $26 per share. It is the most eagerly anticipated IPO on Wall Street in quite some time, but some still question Twitter's ability to generate profits. Ira Spitzer has more from New York.
Microblogging site has become a favorite among world leaders and celebrities, but will it be a hit on Wall Street? That question will start to be answered as Twitter commences trading on the New York Stock Exchange. In the build-up to its initial public offering, Twitter raised about $1.8 billion, which means that the company is already valued at $18 billion, a very high number when considering that Twitter has lost more than $300 million in the last 3 years. However, other social media companies, like Facebook, LinkedIn, and Yelp, have proved to be very successful on the public market. Facebook, the company to whom Twitter is most often compared, went through a turbulent IPO process, but the price eventually shot up again after its earnings spiked. Ira Spitzer, New York.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The U.S. economy grew by 2.8% in the third quarter of this year, a faster-than-expected rate. The release of the latest GDP figures shows a good improvement compared to data for this time last year. Meanwhile, the European Central Bank has lowered its main interest rate to a record low of 0.25%, in a move that surprised markets and sent the euro tumbling. ECB President Mario Draghi says action is needed to reflect a prolonged period of low inflation and weak recovery predicted for the eurozone. In other news, Pakistan's Taliban has named Mullah Fazlullah as their new leader. The country's previous two Taliban heads were killed by U.S. drone strikes. Hakimullah Massoud, who was one of the world's most wanted men, was taken out last week. Mullah Fazlullah is known for his men's shooting of Pakistani youth leader Malala Yousafzai. And the leader of the M23 rebels in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, Sultan Makenga, has surrendered to Ugandan authorities along with hundreds of rebel fighters. A government spokesperson says Makenga will be kept in Uganda until a peace deal is signed. Isabel Nakiria has more from Kampala.
Uganda government spokesman Ofwono Pondo says Sultan Makenga has handed himself in to authorities and is being held at an undisclosed location. 1,600 rebel fighters also surrendered. They have been disarmed and are now at Magahiga Barracks near the border. The UN imposed a travel ban and a freeze of assets on Makenga last year, but Uganda says it will not impose any further sanctions. The DRC government had earlier said it would not give amnesty to any of the M23 commanders with sanctions against them. Uganda says the final agreement due to be signed on Monday will spell out how each M23 member under sanctions will be held. The rebels announced on Monday they would end their 20-month rebellion and pursue peaceful negotiations.
And that's the latest feature story news. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. This is the kind of messaging the telecommunications giant AT&T wants you to hear. Sound from an advertisement that you can't miss right now if you're watching US television.
It's not complicated. Bigger is better. And AT&T has the nation's largest 4G network.
But this morning, it was the size of AT&T's business relationship with the CIA that came under the microscope. A report in the New York Times suggests that the company enjoys a deal with the Central Intelligence Agency worth more than $10 million a year. The paper says AT&T assists the CIA with terrorism investigations by providing details from its vast database of telephone records, including international calls placed by US customers. In a statement, AT&T says it values the privacy of its customers and works hard to protect it, but it wouldn't comment on the specific allegations contained in the New York Times report, citing national security. FSN's Simon Marks spoke to Jim Harper, the Director of Information Studies at Washington's Cato Institute, and asked him whether this is a straightforward business relationship between the CIA and the telecoms giant.
I don't think it is. I suspect that AT&T has misled many of its partners and misled many of its customers as to whether the data that it processes about and for them is subject to real privacy protections. If the AT&T believes that it can sell information to the CIA without regard to people's privacy interests, that's a huge problem that needs to be rectified.
Now, the company seems to be saying, the New York Times certainly seems to be reporting, that much of this data relates to telephone conversations and communications that took place outside the United States. Is that your understanding?
That is the reporting I'm reading as well. And that doesn't change the basic question of whether AT&T is entitled to take data that it's processing for others and use that data any way it wishes. So there's certainly contractual issues there. There are privacy issues and privacy laws in each country where AT&T does business. The idea of selling it to one nation's government is certainly suspicious.
Now, as a journalist working in Washington, D.C., I am certainly used to hearing government officials, when they're questioned about electronic surveillance, saying that they don't comment on matters concerning national security. I am less used to hearing corporate spokesmen saying that, and yet that appears to be the position AT&T is taking.
Well, some time has passed since AT&T was the government telephone network, but it did enjoy a government-backed monopoly for most of the last century. And it seems to be acting as though it is still part of that circle. Consumers may want to consider whether they do business with AT&T, given revelations like this. Of course, all the telecommunications providers have been one way or another forced to turn over information. But if AT&T is doing it voluntarily, that's something consumers should consider when they decide who to do business with.
And the difference here, Jim, is that they are not being ordered to do this by a court. They're not, in fact, being forced to do this, according to the New York Times reporting today. They've struck a commercial deal to do it.
There's a fuzzier line between voluntary action and forced action when it comes to large businesses dealing with large governments, because governments can persuade with the threat of withholding contracts or the threat of regulatory actions, things that seem voluntary when, in fact, they're really not. So it's uncertain whether AT&T is 100% volunteer, but they're certainly not battling this in court, and that's apparent from the fact that this is under a contract and not being required by subpoena or warrant.
We do not know if other telecommunications giants are engaged in similar business relationships with the CIA. Would you be surprised if they were?
I would be. I would be surprised. I would be disappointed. But I would also be resigned to the fact that the communication system that has developed up to this point has been very much a governmental communication system that serves our governments much more as it serves individual consumers. We need a redesign of our communications, a redesign of the Internet and many parts of Internet security so that our communications serve us, protecting our interests in privacy and free speech.
And speaking of resignation, do you think that there will be a consumer upswing of concern created by this report, or do you think that this will just be, at the end of the day, another in a long line of reports indicating that extensive electronic surveillance is underway and, in this case, consumers may end up just tolerating it?
Well, this goes into the total mix of considerations that consumers bring when they make their choices. Frankly, corporations make their profit on the margin, and so a marginal consumer who's deciding between AT&T and some other provider may move to other providers based on this news. That should cause AT&T, if it recognizes its interests, to start to pare back on this program or perhaps eliminate it entirely.
The U.S. Department of Corrections is being accused of adopting a new form of lethal injection that medical experts believe could result in a long and agonizing death. Next Thursday, a convicted murderer in Ohio is due to receive the controversial new cocktail of drugs. The new drugs have emerged following tighter controls regulating the components used in lethal injection executions. Earlier, professor at Fordham Law School, Deborah Denno, told me that these new drugs are an unknown entity.
With these new drugs is that they've never been tried before on a human being. So it's an experiment. Nobody knows. Even experienced doctors don't know how these drugs are going to react. What they think is that they could go on for a very long time because their effectiveness is not nearly as strong as the kinds of drugs that have been used up to this point.
I understand that next Thursday this new cocktail is going to be used for the first time.
That's right. It's been used already in one case, in the case of William Happ. It is going to be used again in another case. And the first case in which it was used, it apparently caused problems. I mean, eyewitness reports were that the inmate, William Happ, took longer to die, that he seemed to be in great discomfort, and he seemed to be in some pain.
Can you give us a timeline here? The last few years have seen new regulations introduced over the use of drugs in executions.
Well, what we've seen, particularly in the last 5 years, is states changing their methods of execution in terms of using drugs and the number of drugs. And what started this? I mean, there's several reasons for this. First of all, in 2008, there was a United States Supreme Court case that validated the use of a three-drug cocktail that had been used in the United States starting in 1977. All of a sudden, in 2008, you start to see states changing. So almost immediately after this case, 2 months later, Ohio changed from three drugs to just one drug, and we started to seeing from 2009 to 2013 about a dozen states doing the same kind of thing. The second thing that happened was, that couldn't have been predicted, was there was a nationwide shortage of drugs generally in the United States, and this definitely had effect on executions and the drugs that Department of Corrections could use. They were no longer available. So what happened was Department of Corrections started to go to foreign sources, England, China, Pakistan, Austria, Germany, etc., to see if they could get drugs from these other countries. The problems with that is those drugs are not FDA approved. And there was a lawsuit this summer against the FDA that said that any drug used in an execution had to be FDA approved, in which case Department of Corrections didn't have that road to go down to. Lastly, some of the companies that were making these drugs absolutely refused to do it anymore once they found out they were being used in executions. So the first drug that was ever used in this country in lethal injections from, 1982 up to, the present time, the company manufacturing that drug said they weren't going to do it anymore. Department of Corrections went to use another drug, and the company manufacturing that drug said they weren't going to do it anymore, in which case you see Department of Corrections just scrambling to find a drug that they can use in an execution. It looks like this is something very recent, when in fact, I've been writing on this topic for 22 years, and to me it's just variations on a theme. When I first started writing, the big execution method that was targeted then was electrocution, and there were numerous problems with electrocution. So then states readily start changing to lethal injection, and there were lawsuits from the get-go with lethal injection starting in 1977. So this has been going on for three decades. We see worse problems in the last 5 years than we have ever seen since the beginning of this execution method. And the reason I emphasize that is one concern that people have always had with the focus on execution methods was that Department of Corrections were going to come up with this perfect method, and then anti-death penalty people were going to be in really strapped because there wouldn't be arguments against these methods anymore, when in fact the methods have never been worse than they are today.
Professor at the Fordham Law School, Deborah Denno. New data on sexual assault in the military shows a nearly 50% increase in complaints over this past year, with over 3,500 reported instances of rape, sodomy, and other unwanted sexual contact. That number does not include cases of sexual harassment. In testimony before a congressional panel on Thursday, Pentagon leaders said the report shows signs of improvement, with more assault survivors feeling comfortable reporting crimes and seeking justice. But a number of military rape survivors and US senators continue to call for major changes to the military justice system and will try to attach reforms during the upcoming debate on the National Defense Authorization Act. On Capitol Hill, Alice Olstein reports.
For many years in the U.S. Marines, at the barracks in D.C., and in combat in Iraq. During her service, she was sexually assaulted by fellow servicemen. Speaking before senators this week, she said both military's current rules and her commander in particular created a toxic and permissive atmosphere in her unit.
My commander did have the power to deny the presence of harassment. His authority gave him ownership of the truth, yet without accountability. He decided, in writing, that calling officers sluts and whores was not harassment, and that any harassment was deserved because of what I wore or that I'd complained about it. It was the retaliation and condoning of harassment that I believe made those who harmed me feel protected and encouraged.
When her case finally went to trial, she was put through what she described as 15 hours of degrading testimony. She called on the gathered lawmakers, Republicans and Democrats, to pass a bill to take the decision to prosecute outside the chain of command.
It is impossible to expect justice and a legal system run primarily by commanders with no legitimate legal training, who have a vested interest in the outcome of their proceedings and an undeniable favoritisms that are only human nature.
Following a report last year that found that the majority of sexual assaults in the military are never reported, and the vast majority of those reported are never brought to justice, many lawmakers have been calling for legal changes. Missouri Democrat Claire McCaskill introduced a bill to strip commanders of the ability to overturn jury verdicts for those convicted of sexual assault. New York Democrat Kirsten Gillibrand wants to go even further by moving the decision to prosecute outside the chain of command.
Until you have an objective review by a trained military prosecutor who does not have any biases for or against the perpetrator or the victim, will you see justice being done?
Pentagon leaders have come out in strong opposition to Gillibrand's Military Justice Improvement Act, claiming it would, quote, undercut the good order and discipline of the military. Some members of Congress are also opposed, and a filibuster is expected if and when it makes it to the Senate floor. But Gillibrand says her reforms are necessary because the current system is inherently unjust.
If a commander prefers the perpetrator, or the perpetrator is well-liked, or very popular, or more valuable to the unit, that case will not be pushed forward. That is a serious breach of trust and a serious breach in the ability of justice being done within our military.
Another bill introduced this week by California Democrat Barbara Boxer tackles another area of the military justice system, so-called Article 32 hearings, which are used to decide whether there's enough evidence to take a case to a court-martial. Boxer is seeking to exempt victims of sexual assault from having to testify at these hearings, which are open to the public and the press, and limit the kinds of questions lawyers can ask if they choose to take the stand.
At the Article 32, your rapist will be sitting there, and you'll have to relive and retell everything that's happened to you. So it's very intimidating.
That's Miranda Peterson with the advocacy group Protect Our Defenders. She says one hearing at the U.S. Naval Academy this summer proves a clear example of why so few sexual assaults are reported in the military. In that case, a 21-year-old woman who reported being sexually assaulted at a party by three Naval Academy football players was aggressively cross-examined for days by military lawyers. Though the presiding judge barred defense attorneys from asking whether she carried condoms in her purse, they were allowed to ask whether she was wearing a bra or underwear at the time of the assault, whether she lies, quote, at least once a day, and how wide she opens her mouth to perform oral sex.
It's traumatic, it's unnecessary, and we think that making this voluntary, allowing them to submit a statement instead, will make them feel more comfortable with the system, will increase the likelihood that they continue to cooperate, which is crucial to prosecuting these crimes successfully.
Senators will attempt to attach all these proposed reforms as amendments to the National Defense Authorization Act, which Congress will begin debating in the weeks leading up to their Thanksgiving break. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
The White House says U.S. officials in Geneva have approached Iran with a potential compromise over its nuclear program. U.S. Press Secretary Jay Carney outlined the offer earlier.
It is absolutely the right approach, in our view, to test whether or not they're serious, and to do that in a careful way that would have as its first step an agreement to, potentially, if there is an agreement, to halt all advancement on Iran's nuclear program, and to potentially roll it back. And in exchange for that, to allow for some temporary moderate relief, but reversible relief. And then we would explore whether or not, in a verifiable, transparent, and meaningful way, Iran was willing to assure the international community that it has forsaken its nuclear weapons program.
The West is convinced Iran is developing a nuclear weapons program, although the Islamic Republic maintains that its atomic ambitions are peaceful. Earlier, I spoke to reporter for AlMonitor.com, Laura Rosen, who's in Geneva for the two-day talks between Iran and the six world powers, and she told me that there's more pace to this latest round of negotiations.
So it seemed like the two sides today are actually moving pretty swiftly, tried to reach an agreement on a two-phase nuclear deal. There'll probably be more specificity on the first phase, in which the six powers would like Iran to suspend the expansion of its nuclear program for, say, 6 months in exchange for some limited sanctions relief, during which time then the parties can try to negotiate a big deal, a comprehensive deal. The point of doing it this way is you're not having Iran's program expanding all the time while you're having this big, difficult negotiation, and Iran can maybe get some limited sanctions relief, so this kind of more moderate team in power can have something to show for its engagement. As you've seen, they've been getting some pushback from hardliners in Iran, and I think they're anxious to show they can deliver.
And what are U.S. officials hoping to achieve in Geneva?
So U.S. officials would like to be able to get pretty close, either at this meeting or the next meeting, to what would be in the phase one agreement. They haven't specified what the elements would be, but the ideas are not new. It would be that Iran might suspend its 20% enrichment, that it would continue probably to transition its 20% stockpile into a form that couldn't be higher enriched for a weapon, that it might decommission or stop doing work on the Iraq heavy water facility so that Iran wouldn't have a second route, a plutonium route to a nuclear weapon, as some fear, and some measures like that. The sanctions relief that U.S. officials say they would give Iran for such steps would not be the major oil and banking sanctions that have had the most impact on Iran's economy, but stuff more on the margins. They could give some relief, but that wouldn't remove the incentive for Iran to do a bigger deal later on.
When do we expect negotiations to actually reach more of an agreement?
It's interesting because usually, as you know, the officials would try to lower expectations before each meeting so that they don't disappoint. They didn't go to huge length to make us think that it's impossible they would get some preliminary framework agreement this meeting, which is supposed to end tomorrow. The deputy foreign minister for Iran came through today and suggested it could possibly be this meeting or possibly there'll be another meeting in Geneva in a couple weeks' time.
Almonitor.com reporter Laura Rosen in Geneva. A vast new deepwater port has opened on the outskirts of London, and it could have a major impact for African exporters. London Gateway is its name, and its first cargo arrived up the River Thames on a ship from South Africa. And the port already has an international flavour with a strong Chinese and Middle Eastern influence. And FSN's Ollie Barrett was there to see the first goods unloaded.
It's taken a decade of construction, but London Gateway is now open for business, and in huge containers is the first produce to arrive here on a 58,000-ton ship. Car parts and fruit and wine from South Africa. And an awful lot of it, according to David Moore of JFH Hillebrand Logistics.
I would say on this ship you're looking at somewhere in the region of 1.7 million bottles of South African wine destined for the UK markets. Yeah, and much of that will be drunk as we approach Christmas, of course.
The site in Essex to the east of London is vast, but Simon Moore, the chief executive of London Gateway, believes the project has brought wide benefits.
We're physically three times the size the city of London. We've had more than 10,000 people working here at London Gateway to date. 80% of everything that's been acquired and utilised here has come from UK companies. Our primary construction company is based here in the south of the UK. So the ripple effect to the UK economy is massive. Everything from the carpets to the curtains, the air conditioners, the cementing, the roadworks, the drainage, environmental works, archaeologists, lawyers, taxis, hotels. The ripple effect is huge.
London Gateway has been built with private money. The port's owner and operator is Dubai-based DP World. Mohammed Sharaf is the group's chief executive, and he thinks this is a return to what London used to be good at.
It's historical and exciting for UK and Londoners, especially the Londoners, because London started as a port city long, long time back. And as the city grew and the economy grew, the ports were shifted away from it. Today, we're bringing the port back to the city, so it's a proud moment for all of us.
It all works in reverse as well. The first ship to dock here will return to Africa laden with goods from Europe. All lifted on and off the vessels by Chinese-built cranes, 138 metres high and each weighing as much as 264 double-decker London buses. But with all that South African fruit and wine to unload each week, they'll be busy. Ollie Barrett at London Gateway in Essex.
And that's the Thursday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of the programme by emailing us, reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're there, @featurestory. Coming up on Friday, Iran's nuclear programme will be in focus as crucial talks wind up in Geneva. That's Friday. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.